You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. The Romanticism of Atlas Shrugged by Ben Baer.
Welcome, everyone. We're going to talk today about Atlas Shrugged as a romantic novel. Just to introduce myself briefly, I'm Ben Baer. I'm a fellow and instructor at the Ayn Rand Institute. One thing I'll tell you about myself is that a couple of years ago, Greg Salmieri and I did something called the Atlas Project, which was a and Carrie Ann was with us too, which was the chapter by chapter reading group about Atlas Shrugged. And it's all still available online in several different formats, but the easiest way to find it is to go to atlasproject.live. Some of the material we're going to talk about today comes from things I learned about the book by doing that project. And I think there's a lot more you can learn from listening to the recordings yourself, so I encourage you to do that. But to get us started today, I want to just issue a warning, which is a spoiler alert. There's going to be some spoilers, some significant spoilers about the novel in what I discuss. And so if you haven't actually read it yet, now is your chance. You have a choice to save, you know, a wonderful aesthetic experience for yourself. And that's going to start from the very beginning, because I want to plunge right in with a scene from the book that I'm going to read for you. And it's from close to the end. And so this is a big spoiler. I mean, so please. So let me just go right ahead. Most of you will recognize what's happening here. She leapt to her desk and seized the telephone receiver. Her hand stopped in midair. Then slowly, twistedly, with the greatest effort ever demanded of her, she began to move her arm down to place the receiver back. It seemed to her that it took a long time, as if her arm had to move against some atmospheric pressure that no human body could combat. And in the span of these few brief moments, in the stillness of a blinding pain, she knew what Francisco had felt that night 12 years ago, and what a boy of 26 had felt when he had looked at his motor for the last time. So I have a question for you. And when I ask questions of you, please feel free to just call out short answers that come to mind or thoughts. So question about this scene. What's happening here? What is Dagny doing? Yes?
Deciding to not try to save the railroad.
Anything else? She's giving up, you say? Is that what you said?
Yeah,
giving up the railroad. Okay. More?
Yeah, she's realizing that, you know, the looters are going to just keep taking advantage of her, and she's deciding she's not going to cooperate with it anymore.
She's not cooperating with the looters. Yeah. Carrie Ann?
She's also understanding what this other person must have gone through, and she sees what it looks like afterwards, when there's something on the other side.
So she's seeing some commonality between what she's doing and what others have done in the past, in particular Francisco and this boy of 26. It's of course Galt she's talking about. I mean, there's lots of things that she's doing here. You can describe it on a very simple level, on a more abstract level. Simple level, she's putting down a phone, right? But you also know that she's just gotten the news the Taggart Bridge across the Mississippi has collapsed. Her natural instinct is to rush into action to try to solve the problem. But she's resisting that urge. There's this atmospheric pressure that she's pushing back against, almost like there's some burden that she's been carrying for a long time, but now she's sloughing it off. But in the context of the overall plot, yes, what she's doing is she's deciding not to save her company, and she's going on strike. And if you want to say really the most abstract thing you can, I think, about this kind of scene, it's that she's making a very dramatic choice. And the idea of dramatic choice is something I want to talk about a lot today. She's making a dramatic choice, but it's not just a blind dramatic choice. It's one that she's making for a conscious reason. As Carrie Ann pointed out, she's making it for what she takes to be the same reason that Francisco and Galt had. So today I'm going to talk about why facing and resolving conflicts of the kind that Dagny is here facing and resolving is typical of the romanticism of a novel like Atlas Shrugged. Tomorrow, second part of this class, I'm going to talk more about how and why Dagny is able to resolve that conflict, how that connects to what I think is an important theme of the novel, which I think also expresses the romanticism of the story. So this is a conference that's on the anniversary of the Romantic Manifesto. There's been a lot of discussion of the Romantic Manifesto so far. But what is romanticism? Why is it called the Romantic Manifesto? Does anybody remember roughly what Ayn Rand's definition of romanticism is? What defines the romantic school of art?
Demonstrating free choice.
It represents things as they could be, not as they are.
Represents things as they could be, not as they are.
Volition in the pursuit of values.
Volition in the pursuit of values. One more.
The successful achievement of those values.
And the successful achievement of those values. I mean, I think all of these are true characterizations of what romantic art, but especially literature, amounts to for Rand. But it's worth, just for the record, recording her formal definition of the concept. And if you want to know what she thinks romanticism is, you look to the essay, which is entitled, What is Romanticism? Good place to look. Here's her formal definition. Romanticism is a category of art based on the recognition of the principle that man possesses the faculty of volition. A number of the other things that I think several of you said about romanticism follow from this in one way or another. They're a consequence of this identification of romanticism as recognizing the principle that man possesses volition. Well, what is volition? It's the human capacity to make choices. It's free will. It's the fact that you're not determined by your genetics or your environment or any other force beyond your control, that you're in control of your destiny, that you have the ability to do otherwise. It's a philosophic issue that is at stake in the Romantic school of literature and art more generally. Now, Romanticism is usually contrasted with the naturalist school of literature, especially in that essay, What is Romanticism? That's what she has the most to say about there. But in what way does romantic literature recognize that man possesses the faculty of volition in a way that naturalism doesn't? Naturalism is like, I mean, representatives include people like Sinclair Lewis, Balzac, Tolstoy, many, many others. But here's the thing, I mean, Sinclair Lewis did not write science fiction. Why do I say that? Sinclair Lewis didn't portray men as robots. There are characters in these novels that are what you're doing. It looks like what they're doing is making choices. I've been reading Elmer Gantry lately, one of Lewis's more noteworthy books. And Elmer Gantry is a guy who chooses to become a minister, and then he chooses to become a traveling salesman, and then he chooses to become a minister again, and he chooses which mistresses he's going to have an affair with and which kinds of hypocrisy he's going to engage in. The whole thing's a satire of religious hypocrisy, and a really good book, by the way. So they're making choices in these naturalistic stories. Why is romanticism so different? And what I want to discuss today, and I want to use Atlas Shrugged as an example of it, is that what's characteristic of romanticism is not simply the fact that it portrays people making choices. It's something more profound than that. And it's something that makes the aesthetic experience, I think, of romanticism so profound. So Ayn Rand has a lot more to say about what romanticism is and what characterizes it in that essay, What is Romanticism? It's noteworthy that, I mean, she's defining it as the literary school that expresses the recognition of volition. She's a philosopher who has a whole theory of volition and how people make choices. And it's something that comes out, especially in Galt's speech. But interestingly, there's a lot that she has to say just in her essay on What is Romanticism about it. She notes there that human volition operates with respect to two major areas of our life. And she uses some of her technical terminology to categorize these. There's volition with respect to consciousness and volition with respect to existence. So the first is the choices that we exercise with regard to our own internal psychological life, how we form our character. And then what she calls volition with regard to existence is the choices we make in our actual physical action as we navigate through the world. And what I want to do for the rest of the day today is to basically break down Atlas Shrugged insofar as it portrays each of these along both of these lines. I'll talk about one, then I'll talk about the other, because she thinks that there's one or another literary tool that focuses on one of these kinds of volition more than the other. If what we're talking about is how do people govern their own internal psychological lives, the main literary device that authors use to express that is characterization. How, and that's kind of obvious if it's volition with regard to character, how does the author portray characters? How does the author portray the characters as developing? Anybody know what the main literary tool related to volition in regard to existence, existential action would be?
Plot.
Plot is the way she puts it at one point. And I'm actually going to start by talking about plot and then go back to characterization, because I think it's easier to get the discussion started about with regard to plot. Though I think it'll turn out that characterization ends up being super important and very distinctive to Romanticism. So she says that it's plot that does the most to convey volition in action. But the question then is how and why and what is plot? Well, turning to a different essay of hers in The Romantic Manifesto, there's basic principles of literature, and she gives a formal definition of plot. She says, plot is a purposeful progression of logically connected events leading to the resolution of a climax. And it's worth unpacking a few things in that definition. One is that, and she says even more about this in the essay, that plot isn't just a series of accidental occurrences. And I would go a little further and bring out an especially important point, which is that it's not even just a series of chosen events. As I mentioned before, you look at naturalistic stories and you see Elmer Gantry making one choice after another, and yet that's not Romanticism. So what then does it mean to talk about logically connected events leading to the resolution of a climax, and how does that in some way convey volition? It's, by the way, just as a clarifying point, it's also worth noting that, I mean, so Ayn Rand thought that plot was the most important tool that Romanticists had at their disposal in conveying volition. Not all Romanticism uses plot. Does anybody know what Ayn Rand's favorite book that didn't have a plot was? Well, I'll simplify it for you. Does anybody know what Ayn Rand's favorite novel was? Calumet K. Yeah, I don't know if everybody's read that, but she has a review of it in an old issue of The Objectivist, and it's a story about a guy named Charlie Bannon. I keep wanting to say Steve Bannon. Charlie Bannon, it's a story of his building a grain elevator, and he goes up against all kinds of different obstacles, but they're unrelated obstacles. She doesn't really explain exactly why she doesn't think it has a plot, but she does say that in her review, that it's plotless. More than that, does anybody know which one of Ayn Rand's own works, prominent one of her works, by her own admission, doesn't have a plot? Anthem. You don't need to bring the mic just when they start asking questions. Yeah, Anthem. I mean, she says that it's mostly a psychological conflict that equality is dealing with. He doesn't really come into conflict with any other individuals, just against a society. Ask me more about that. I can read you the passage from The Art of Fiction where she describes that later if you're interested. But that'll set the context a bit for what we're about to discuss. What plot really is. I mean, it's not just a series of even chosen actions. It's a real focus on choice in a certain way. It's important here to remember that fiction is a form of art, and art is not just journalism. It's not just history. It's not just showing people doing things and reporting the fact that they made certain choices. Art is a selective recreation of reality, right? So it's the result of an artist surveying the world, integrating some principles from their observation, deciding to really focus on and amplify certain things they've observed from life in order to convey what they think is important about life, what they think is metaphysically significant about life. So Romanticism shows, and by way of plot, does show people making choices, but it does it in a special way that brings the fact that it's a choice into real relief. And it does that, I think, by doing two major things, which you can see in this definition. What happens when people make choices in a plot, first of all, is that they are making choices in the pursuit of a purpose, a long-range purpose, the kind that's distinctive of human beings. And they do it in the face of a conflict, a dramatic conflict. And it's I think, both of those put together that really shows that what they're doing is a choice. So think about it like this. You have some kind of object, and it is moving along, and it meets with a certain obstacle, and it goes off on a tangent. I mean, for all you know, it could just be bouncing off the obstacle, like an inanimate object would, not making a choice. But now if you see that object meets with an obstacle, and it moves off this way, but then it comes back, and it meets with another obstacle, and then it comes back, and another, and finally, it goes on its way. That is a sign that what you're dealing with is not just an inanimate object, but a human being with volition. Sorry. So plot is like a special kind of stress test that brings into relief the fact that what we're dealing with is a being with volition. I mean, Elmer Gantry, in A Naturalistic Story, the way that he makes decisions, and he might as well be an inanimate object in a certain way, because he is sort of just bouncing off against various obstacles that he encounters. We'll say a little bit more about why that's the case shortly. Okay. So we said that central to plot is conflict. Let's talk a little bit more about conflict, especially in the context of Atlas Shrugged. What's the central conflict in Atlas Shrugged? Atlas is about who versus whom, or who versus what? Looters versus producers. Anybody want to say anything else?
Strikers versus society.
Strikers versus society. Any other way of putting that? Yeah? Dagny versus Galt. Okay, now those are all slightly different. Actually, especially when you bring in Dagny versus Galt, very different from initially from looters versus strikers. The fact that this is slightly difficult to describe is, I think, itself important. Ayn Rand herself gave a formulation of what she thought the central conflict of Atlas was. It's described by the literary concept she uses, the plot theme. And her description of the plot theme, which is the central conflict, was the men of the mind going on strike against an altruist collectivist society. And I think, yeah, you can summarize that by saying the strikers versus the looters, but Dagny is an interesting puzzle for this characterization. So if you just put it as men of the mind going on strike against an altruist collectivist society, or strikers versus looters, whose side is Dagny on? Both, it depends. The looters.
You don't know that at first, obviously.
What's that?
You don't know which side she's on.
You don't know which side she's on? She's figuring it out. You're starting to see what's the issue here.
Until she goes on strike, she's not part of the men of the mind going on strike.
Yeah.
So.
And so she doesn't really, she's not a looter. She certainly doesn't think of herself as a looter. She thinks she's against them, right? Including her own brother, who she thinks is a looter. But she's not a striker either, because she doesn't go on strike until fairly late in the book. The strikers call her a scab, and they won't have her until she makes a commitment. So she's in conflict with the strikers too, but she's in love with one of the strikers. things get friendship status, it's complicated. So she's in love with one of the people that she's against. That means that she's also in conflict with herself. That's an interesting conflict. That's an interesting dramatic conflict. Now, what does this amount to? What is the basic conflict? What, if you had to characterize what she has to choose between, the two basic things she has to choose between, what would it be?
To be or not to be.
On some level, you may be right, but we have to get to that point.
Maybe her railroad and her beliefs on Galt.
Her railroad versus Galt. I think that's a good way of putting it. The world of her, and I would widen it a bit. It's not just her railroad. It's the world that her railroad is connected to versus the world of the inventor of the motor. And I put it as inventor of the motor, not Galt yet, because the conflict starts to emerge before she even knows that there is a Galt or that Galt is the inventor of the motor. Once she discovers that there is this motor and somebody invented it, so why is there this conflict? Why does she feel pulled in each direction? It's really her love for the world of the railroad. I mean, she grew up with it. She admired Nathaniel Taggart, the founder, her ancestor. She aspires to run it someday. She eventually gets to run it in spite of James's opposition, and even builds the John Galt line and experiences the sense of achievement that comes from that. But on the other hand, she discovers this motor, and the fact that some man built this inspires her. And you start to see, actually very early in the story, that her interest, that these two loves start to diverge. As early as the end of part one, when they're trying to kill Colorado with all the regulations, she leaves that to James and goes off in search of the inventor of the motor, when you'd think that that would be the time to stay and fight. And then at the end of part two, of course, this becomes particularly pronounced still before she knows Galt. She's supposed to be going to Colorado to deal with the tunnel disaster, but Owen Kellogg tells her a story, and she goes off on an airplane, again, in search of the inventor of the motor. And of course, when she then does meet Galt and falls in love with him, the fact that she has to make this choice becomes especially obvious. But the plot is set up in a way where she can't have both. She has to choose. Why is that? Why does she have to choose? What is it about the plot that makes her have to?
She just can't do both at the same time.
But why not? Why can't she do both?
There are contradictions.
There are
in action. It's the actions that it would take for her to live in either of those worlds is exclusive to them.
So there's a contradiction between the two. We'll have to see why more, but I think you're right.
She realizes the world of the railroad is going to destroy the world of the inventor of the motor.
Well, she doesn't realize that quite soon enough. I don't know. Or maybe the other way around, she doesn't realize soon enough. One more.
The world of her railroad is slowly killing her. She gets so little sustenance out of it, and she's helping keep it going.
So the world of the railroad is killing her.
Yeah, and so very slowly.
Is there any one factor in this story more than anything else makes her choose between these two?
Yeah, Galt doesn't let her.
Galt himself. I mean, those are his terms. You can't come to this valley until you take the oath. And you can't do that until you really understand the reasons for it with your own mind. Also that, and the fact that he's eventually captured and they're going to kill him. And at that point, all bets are off. But I want to emphasize with all this that what Dagny is now doing, especially in that final scene, is not just making any old choice, right? She's making a really hard choice. It's one that is going to involve rethinking all of her values, ones that she's been, committed to since very young. And when she makes this choice, she's going to tell us who she really is. She's going to show us something about her character. And so this is a way in which plot opens a window to character. And this is why I'm going to start to talk about characterization in a moment. Plot and characterization, all these major literary devices, they're all really integrated with each other. She says the novel's a whole, and you can't totally separate them from each other. And this is, I think, an example, both because the plot shows us something about Dagny, but here the plot is being pushed forward by Galt and the fact that he's not letting her do both. Ask me, if there's time later, what I think Atlas Shrugged would be like if there weren't a plot like this. I'll do the same thing for the other major point. But let's talk about the other major point. Let's talk about volition in character. So as I mentioned, she thinks that it's characterization in fiction that is the romanticist's major tool in portraying volition in regards to our consciousness. And she says that the way that this happens is in large part because of the choices of the author. That romantic authors, because they're not just naturalistic reporters, they're actually inventing characters. They're choosing the type of character they want to portray. And they're able to do that because there's some basic building blocks of human psychology that can be arranged in all kinds of different ways, all kinds of novel ways. Those basic building blocks are moral abstractions. And those are then the motives that motivate the characters and their choices. And I really want to emphasize this point because I think it's really crucial to what makes romanticism romanticism. This is another passage from What is Romanticism, dealing with the issue of characterization. And what she says is, top-rank romanticists are enormously concerned with man's soul, i.e. his consciousness. They are moralists in the most profound sense of the word. Their concern is not merely with values, but specifically with moral values and with the power of moral values in shaping human character. In their stories, one will never find action for action's sake unrelated to moral values. The events of their plots are shaped, determined, and motivated by the characters' values or treason to values, by their struggle in pursuit of spiritual goals, and by profound value conflicts. So, I mentioned before, we put on the screen the two things that I think Dagny had to choose between. That was the essence of her conflict. But at that point, I had put it in a less abstract way, in a way that didn't yet bring in any kind of moral concepts. But I want to do that because if you don't, you don't really have romanticism yet. If all that Dagny is doing is choosing between her two loves, and it's just like a question, which do I love more? Then all you have is something like an emotional conflict. One emotion versus the other, which one's more powerful, which one's going to win out. That's not yet romanticism. There's plenty of naturalistic stories, and you see this again in Elmer Gantry, where he makes choices because of a certain overpowering emotion. And there's a question I asked before, well, in what way does romanticism portray volition that naturalism doesn't, given that naturalist authors portray people making choices? And this is, I think, really the nub of the issue, because in naturalism, they make choices, but they make them on the basis of only moral, or it's only emotional grounds. Most people who believe in determinism, who don't believe in free will, believe that because when they introspect and decide why do I do what they do, they don't understand why they do what they do. I just felt like doing it. It's only if you think there's a reason for the feeling that you choose, where you are the one who's in charge of your reason, that's when you have real free will, and that's when you have romanticism. And I want to recommend, yesterday in his talk, Greg Salmieri generally recommended the aesthetic work of Tora Buchman, and I want to get behind that 100%. And he mentioned some very good works. I want to mention a more obscure essay of Tora's, if you can find it, but there's an old TIA intellectual activist essay from 1993 that Tora wrote called Conscious and Subconscious Motivation in Literature. It's in two parts back in 1993. Super excellent essay that I think clarifies a lot of these issues. Certainly did for me. And so if you can find it, I recommend getting your hands on it. Conscious and Subconscious Motivation in Literature from TIA in 93. So Dagny's conflict is not just an emotional conflict. There's something more to it. And we need to think about, well, what are each of those concretes, love for her railroad, love for the inventor of the motor and its world, what do those represent to her? moral values do they represent to her? So start with one. What does her love for the railroad represent to her? Abstractly. Sorry? Purpose? Anything else? Yeah?
A sense of personal accomplishment.
Sense of accomplishment? Yeah?
What man is capable of.
What man is capable of? Good. Yeah, I mean, I would put it, I think this sums up what several of you said. It's her celebration of achievement, but her, not just her celebration, she believes it's moral. She believes achievement is holy, that it's sacred. And a correlative of that is that she thinks renouncing the pursuit of achievement is an evil thing. And she's always talking about how I don't believe in giving up. I don't believe in renunciation. That's the railroad. What about Galt? What about the inventor of the motor and his world? What kind of abstract value does that represent for her?
Can you repeat the question?
What does her love for Galt represent, morally speaking? What's the moral value at stake there for her? Why does she love Galt? Why does she love the inventor of the motor? What's that?
The best in man.
The best in man?
Rational and has integrity.
I mean, I would put it as, it definitely has something to do with her worship for ability. But I think it's a little bit more than that because she knows early on that the inventor's, he's gone away and the world has mistreated him. She knows about the 20th Century Motor Company. And once, especially she knows about Galt, she knows there's an issue of justice here. Why should people of ability have to put up with the kind of injustice that they deal with? And she feels the pull of both of these values, but she thinks they're in conflict with each other. And morality can't be on the side of both of these because, as we already talked about, it's inconsistent. She has to choose. So if she wants to be moral, she has to choose. She has to resolve the conflict. She has to figure out which side morality is really on here. And this is an intellectual obstacle that she has to face. You know, she could just be complacent about it and say, oh, you know, people have contradictions. Contradictions exist. But she knows enough to check her premises, and she's struggling to check her premises throughout the course of the novel. And tomorrow especially, we'll look at the major premise that she needs to check and challenge before she can fully resolve this conflict. But before we get to that, I think there is still a little we can say about why she feels like there is this dilemma, why she can't figure out, you know, why it seems like there's this contradiction for her. And I want to read for you another passage where I think the dilemma that she's facing really comes out. And this is from when she's in the valley for the first time. And she's been there, I think, for most of the month. But she sees Henry Reardon's plane in the sky, and she's now, it all comes back to her, what's going on in the outside world. This is a great portrayal of, I think, her internal intellectual drama and internal conflict. So she sees Reardon's plane. If she left the valley, the screen would close on her as tightly. Atlantis would descend under a vault of rays more impregnable than the bottom of the ocean, and she, too, would be left to struggle for the things she had not known how to see. On the other hand, but the pull of the outer world, the pull that drew her to follow the plane, was not the image of Hank Reardon. The pull was the vision of Hank Reardon's courage and the courage of all those still fighting to stay alive. Was she certain that no chance remained for the world of Taggart Transcontinental? Was she certain that the terms of the battle were such that she could not care to win? Until and unless she saw that no chance was untaken and no battle unfought, she had no right to remain among them, that is, the men of the valley. This was the question that had lashed her for weeks but had not driven her to a glimpse of the answer. So it's, I think, notable here that as she's facing this internal conflict, it's not just she sees Reardon and she remembers her love for Reardon, and then she sees the valley and, oh, but she loves Galt, and which one do I love more? No, it's not even about the love for Reardon anymore, because it's what Reardon has in common with all those left in the world who are fighting to stay alive. and the vision of their courage, which is a moral value. And she says she doesn't have a right to abandon them by staying in the valley until she decides she doesn't have a chance of beating the looters. So it's not just some dilemma over how much she happens to feel or how uncertain she is about likely outcome. There's an issue of principle here for her. Doesn't morality demand her to stay in the world and fight for those who have courage? Question? I'll get to you too. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Also, with respect to what she could possibly achieve, like in the valley, she starts thinking about running track for Francisco, who's compromised. Mm-hmm. She's like, "What? All that work for six miles in track when I could do thousands out here?" So, in some sense, does she feel hampered by her ability to use her achievement to the maximum possible?
And I think that's. So you're saying that she doesn't think that what she can achieve in the value is significant enough. I think that's definitely another sign that she still has this love for the world and what might be achievable there, for sure. You had a question back there?
I think that, and you were talking about the phone in the beginning, she finally comes to the realization that as long as she's out there fighting, she's actually helping the enemy.
Well, this is going to be the big thing that she has yet to discover, obviously. And we're going to talk about that a lot tomorrow, about when she realized. I mean, it has a lot to do with her view that she could still beat the looters. Well, if she's actually helping them, then she couldn't, right? But she hasn't figured that out yet. And we're going to find out how and why she does. I want to read to you one last passage. I don't know why I'm pointing it this way. Also describing the kind of drama she's facing. And this one's especially noteworthy because it's after she's made her decision to go back to the world. And so she's now giving her reason to Galt why she's going back. And she says, "I started my life with a single absolute, that the world was mine to shape in the image of my highest values and never to be given up to a lesser standard, no matter how long or hard the struggle." There's the view that renunciation is evil. "Now I know that I was fighting for this valley. It was this valley that I saw as possible and would exchange for nothing less and would not give up to a mindless evil." Wait, so why doesn't she want to stay in the valley then? "I'm going back to fight for this valley, to release it from its underground, to regain for it its full and rightful realm, to let the earth belong to you, in fact, as it does in spirit. Or, if I fail, to remain in exile from this valley to the end of my life. I will fight for it, even if I have to fight against you, even if you damn me as a traitor, even if I am never to see you again." So she's stating how at this moment she's trying to resolve this contradiction. She thinks morality demands her to go back. She doesn't believe in renouncing the pursuit of values in the world. But yeah, she understands there's these values at stake in the valley, and she believes in them, and she loves Galt. How does she reconcile this contradiction? "Well, when I go back to the world, I will be fighting for the spirit of this valley, but notably, not necessarily the body of it, as it were, because she's accepting the possibility that she may never be able to come back and she may never be able to have Galt because of Galt's own terms." And so there's a hint here of the idea, there's this possibly unrealizable ideal that she's struggling, this kind of conjuring up a sort of mind-body dichotomy. And Galt reminds her of that right after she says this. And so if her way of resolving the contradiction is to say, maybe values can't be totally achieved in life, that'll be, you know, in his view at least, an unfortunate way of reconciling things. So to sum up, why does she face this conflict? She thinks she can beat the looters. She thinks there's still a chance. And by the way, she's willing to lose Galt in the name of the spirit of what he represents. Well, before she resolves the conflict we mentioned before, she's going to need to decide that one or both of these ideas is mistaken. But I want to emphasize, again, to just drive home the point about what makes this romanticism, that it's not going to be enough for her to say, yeah, I'm not willing to lose Galt in the name of his spirit. I need his body too, because I love him so much. The conflict is an intellectual conflict. And to resolve it, she's going to need to have an intellectual conviction that one way or the other is right. And this connects back to the point that I made about plot before, and another example of how plot and characterization, I think, connect. Because, so plot is the purposeful pursuit. Plot involves the purposeful pursuit of certain choices and values by characters. What's Dagny's purpose? Well, on one hand, that's the big question. What is it she's going to pursue? But on the other hand, there is one purpose that's driving Dagny through the novel no matter what. And the question is, how is it going to get particularized and specified? Dagny believes in doing what's right. She wants to find the best within us. And so, you know, she's battling the looters. She knows they're wrong. Even her own brother, she knows he's wrong, though she can't quite understand why or what went wrong with him. She knows that there's some destroyer out there who's poaching the men of ability, totally inexplicable to her. Seems like it's wrong. Why would anybody do that? Her own ex-boyfriend, Francisco, is ruining the world's economy and stealing all and destroying all the copper, right? And even though he's got this facade of being a playboy, whenever she meets with him, it still seems like the old Frisco. And same old good Francisco. Why would someone so good do such terrible things? So what's the right thing to do in this kind of case? And of course, she's inspired by this inventor, who then turns out to be the destroyer, and she falls in love with him. I mean, she falls in love with him, and yet she still disagrees with him. How could he be wrong? How could this guy she loves so much be wrong? Her big question is, what is right? That's a plot. That's a plot driven by a character with a definite purpose who is now going up against a whole series of related obstacles, and she has to overcome them. And again, you can ask me later what I think Atlas would be like by contrast if it didn't have characters like this. So I'll just close, and then we can open up for questions by saying the way she's going to resolve her conflict intellectually is the topic that I'm going to discuss in tomorrow's class, how she resolves her value conflict because of a crucial philosophic realization. And it's, I think, a philosophic realization that underscores a major theme of the novel, a theme about volition, which I argue makes Atlas Shrugged not just an example of literary romanticism, but because of its distinctive theme, basically a kind of super romanticism. So stay tuned for more on that tomorrow, and I hope to see you then. We have some time for questions. I think we have about 17 minutes. And yeah, Eric, if you could make sure you get a mic when you ask a question. So Kirk?
So I've been curious about Rand's, she's focused on her novels when it comes to romanticism. And I read a lot of short stories, and I've always struggled with how do you apply that, like, are there no romanticist short stories? Because a lot of them don't have this kind of value conflict, this kind of plot. I mean, like Hawthorne, Poe, just so many. But I think they're great short stories.
Yeah.
And are they just great but not romantic? Is it, you know, I'm just always curious about that.
Yeah, I think this is a really great question. And I wonder sometimes whether one would form the concept of romanticism if we didn't yet have the novel as a form of art. I mean, there might be other categories of art that eventually you end up classifying under the same heading as romanticism, but without the novel, and it's interesting, in certain languages, the word for novel is roman, isn't it? So I think the romantic novel is the paradigm case of romanticism, and plot is the paradigm tool that the romantic novelist uses to convey the recognition of volition. But I did mention, it's not the only one, and I mentioned, you know, Anthem and Calumet K. There are kind of lesser ways of conveying that characters have volition. Anthem, for instance, equality is struggling with a question that he has to decide for. It's purely, it's the way she explains it, it's the intellectual question of what is I? What am I? Where do I, how do I get the concept of I? And the existential events in the world are there to help him figure that out, but he's not really in conflict with a single character in the way that, say, Dagny is with Galt, right? Another interesting example here is what she says about We the Living. When she's talking about why Anthem doesn't have a plot, she says, well, you could say that there's a conflict in Anthem, which is equality versus the state, or the individual versus the collective, but she says, a collective is not really a real thing, and it's a collection of individuals. And so in something like We the Living, if it were only Kira versus the state, she says that also wouldn't be a plot. It's crucial for her that Kira is in conflict with Andre, and that's what makes it a plot. So plot's the best tool that romanticists have at their disposal. It's not the only one. There's others in literature. And outside of literature, I think the issue is that you start, so how do you portray somebody making a choice in a painting, for instance, right? It's just it's a still frame. Well, there's a lot that other forms of art can convey indirectly. And so I again want to recommend the work of Tora Beckman, because this is something he makes clear in one of the essays that Greg mentioned yesterday, an old objective standard essay about Caspar David Friedrich, who's a visual romanticist. And the way that Tora explains it is to say, if I recall correctly, that any kind of art that is pursued, that is concerned with the pursuit of individualistic values, conveys and implies the idea of volition, but it's less direct. And for more on that, I'll refer you to Tora's essay. But there's direct portrayal of volition, and there's less direct. I think that's the issue.
I'm certainly interested to hear about this Atlas Shrugged that is not Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah. I think this is an interesting intellectual exercise. What would Atlas look like without, for example, a romantic plot? If it had romantic characterization but not romantic plot. So imagine there's volition and character that's being portrayed, but not in existential action, as she puts it. You could get a hint of this, I think, because in What is Romanticism, she talks about a kind of ranking system of romanticists. And she talks about romantic authors who focus more on one kind of volition than the other. She thinks the ones who do both are the top-ranked romanticists. But she says that, for example, there are romantic authors who focus on grand-scale themes and characters, but have no plots, and there's an overwhelming sense of tragedy. This is, if you remember, what she calls the Byronic view of existence, and she associates it with romantic poets like Byron. And you can kind of get a hint of what an atlas like this would look like, because there are, as we talked about, elements in the story where Dagny's feeling like there are unrealizable ideals. Think of her looking up at the Taggart building in the clouds and feeling a sense of unrequited love. And that's, of course, the view she can't stand, and yet she's tempted by it. So imagine if Dagny works and fights the looters to the very end and never quits. And so she is pursuing an unrealizable ideal. Now, for that to happen, there would have to be one big thing missing from the story. And what would that be? Galt. Yeah. There could be no Galtons. Because a Galt who didn't go on strike wouldn't really be Galt. Now, maybe Dagny herself could be a Galt and figure these kinds of things out. We'd need some other form of conflict for her. But that's my example of Atlas without a romantic plot. Now, Atlas without romantic characters, I think, is especially interesting. This would then be portraying volition in action, but not in characters. And again, one of the things she talks about in What is Romanticism is some of the lesser-ranking romanticists, and she says there's a whole tradition of them who do this. She talks about Walter Scott, Alexandre Dumas, who emphasize volition and action without spiritual goals or significant moral values. And then she says, going further down, we can observe the breakup of romanticism with those who think man doesn't have any volition with regard to consciousness, only with regard to existence. She says, these are stories where you have unusual events enacted by conventional characters. The characters are basically naturalistic. And you wonder, how could people like these people do these kinds of things? And unfortunately, and I don't know what some of you will think of this, but I think you don't have to work very hard to imagine what this kind of Atlas Shrugged would look like, because they made it into three unrelated movies. That's exactly what's happening. Now, to be fair, translating Atlas into a movie is a very difficult thing. And there's a serious question. How do you portray the inner life of characters in the form of a movie? Now, Ayn Rand, I think, succeeded in doing that with the Fountainhead movie, but the people who did those movies didn't, I don't think, even try. And so what you have, I think, is the body of Atlas without the soul. You have characters where you don't know why they're doing what they're doing, and you wonder how people like this could do the sorts of things that they're doing. And particularly eloquent here, in the first part, the first Dagny, the one played by Taylor Schilling, basically is like a robot walking around from scene to scene, and she has no emotion whatsoever. And she doesn't explain why she's doing the things that she's doing. So, I mean, I think, I'm not trying to say you should never like or watch these movies. I think some people are able to like them because they have read the book, and so they're able to kind of project into what they're seeing on screen what they remember from the stories. But for somebody who hadn't read it, I think you would miss such a dimension of what makes this a romantic story.
My brother watched all three of the movies and then got... My brother watched all three of the movies and then got inspired to read the book. And
yeah.
he enjoyed it a lot.
I know people have. Yeah, so it's not that there's no value there. It's just it doesn't have the value of romanticism that I get from the book, at least. Yeah. And this is why it's so important. You know, one of the things that... Ankar and Yaron have been stressing that there's such a personal value associated with art. You can't expect everybody to like what you like. Tara?
Thanks. I want to go back to the first question about short stories, because I may just be ignorant about short story as a form and all, but I guess if I understood the question and your answer right, I don't get why a short story couldn't be romantic.
I guess I dodged the short story example, yeah.
About big values, too, couldn't be just in a really intense, tightly packed, like, is brevity the issue, or could you say a little more about that? Thanks.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't really fully address his question. I myself don't know enough about short stories to give a full answer. I know that there are a lot of short stories that don't have plots. She herself talks about this issue in connection with The Simplest Thing in the World and says it doesn't have a plot. Now, that doesn't mean that no short story could have a plot. And I bet that some do, and I'm not thinking of a good example of one, but... So I think some of them do, probably, and I would need to know more about short stories really to answer, and that's why I was dodging, because I just don't know so much about them. Trying to think.
I'll try Rappaccini's Daughter.
Well, I will say this, that the fact that it's short does put an upper limit on how much you can convey about the characterization. And characterization, and especially the kind that involves moral values, that's crucial to romanticism, and it's part of what drives plot in romanticism. So I'm not saying you can't do it, but it's definitely going to be a challenge to pull off.
Red Pond comes to mind, but it's not really a short story per se. But of Ayn Rand's?
Red Pawn is an example you give, yeah.
I mean, that to me, that has a great conflict and plot.
I remember Ayn Rand in a letter to, I'm sorry.
That's not a question, that's in connection with the short story thing. I remember Ayn Rand writing in a letter to a fellow writer whose name I've forgotten, and she gives advice with a short story, and she says a short story is very different from a novel, because it has to center around one event. There's only one event in a short story, and a romantic novel would be a procession of events leading to a to the resolution of a climax.
Yeah.
So
one question is, can a short story really have a plot if it's short? And it might have maybe a mini plot, or like the short story version of a plot, but is there even space in it for conflict, climax, resolution. Carl? Mike?
Could you clarify why you believe, or why the fact is that Alma Gantry is not a romantic novel? After all, this guy has a purpose to master, dominate people, and ultimately, I mean, he goes various ways, but continues ultimately to the purpose where he actually achieves power over other people.
Well, I have to confess, I haven't finished reading the book yet. But I know where it's headed. I haven't read the synopsis, so I'm about halfway through. And this is, I decided to read it, by the way, because it's an example that Torah analyzes in the essay, the old TIA essay that I mentioned. But I think it's important that, well, the reason why Torah analyzes this example is because the essay is all about the importance of the difference between conscious and subconscious values. So it may well be true that someone like him, this kind of demagogic street preacher type, has some kind of purpose that's driving him underneath the surface, as the evil characters in Ayn Rand's fiction do. James Taggart has a sort of quasi-purpose that's pushing him forward. But very importantly for Taggart, and I think also the case for other characters in naturalistic fiction, they never make it explicit to themselves what it is they want. They don't think about why it's something that they want to pursue, why it's important to pursue. And so even if there's a sort of theme to or an undercurrent to what's pushing them along, that by not being in control of it themselves, they're not exercising volition in the fullest way that human beings are capable of doing, which is focusing your mind on what's true and whether it's right or wrong. But find me again when I finish reading the book and I'll maybe be able to say more. Carrie Ann?
I'd like to take another stab at that short story.
Sure.
Because I don't think she says that it can't be classified as romanticism, just not the highest or fullest, the medium that it can be fully expressed in. And I was wondering why, because I do see like some short stories try to move along a plot by having a series of events, but I think the pitfall there is that the author tells the reader what happens as a way of moving it forward rather than showing in richer detail. And when you tell rather than show, it lessens the art form. So what do you think about that as what hobbles a short story from being able to be fully romantic?
Well, I certainly think there are short stories where it's not just telling, but where there is showing. And I want to be very clear, because what I was saying before about non-novel artworks, and especially about short stories, was not that they're not romantic. I was only saying it's harder for me to see how they have a plot. But there's lots of romanticism that doesn't involve plot. It's just plot is the best tool. So if an author is only telling and not showing, I'm not even clear that necessarily stops it from being romanticism. It's a stylistic deficiency that is going to undercut what Ayn Rand would call the psycho-epistemological function of art, because now you're no longer contemplating a concrete object, you're just getting floating abstractions. So that'll undercut the aesthetic merits of it. Doesn't necessarily mean it's not romanticism. There's good and there's bad romanticism. But I also wanted to say, since people are asking about short stories, the paradigm case of romantic short stories is O. Henry, right? And I've read enough O. Henry where it's not clear to me that they all have anything like a plot, but it is clear to me that these are stories that portray individuals with volition, because what's the most characteristic of O. Henry is that these are interesting people doing interesting things for strange reasons, and unconventional things happen because of it. And it's not maybe in the form of a plot, but there's a real value focus that indirectly, again, implies volition. Are they cutting us off? We have to. Short stories make good character studies. That might be true. Yeah. Are we out of time? Okay. Thank you, everyone. I hope to see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.